It's been a week since the attack on Capitol Hill by a mob of rioters, and I call it an attack and not, you know, just a random incident, because it seems the more we learn about it, the more this was a premeditated act of violence by at least some of the people involved, people who had zip ties, seemingly had a strong understanding of the layout of the Capitol. It's looking more and more like this could have been so much worse than it was, basically due to dumb luck. And so my question, and the question we're going to explore on Worldly, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network today, is how this fits in with the conversation about terrorism that we've been having in this country since 9/11, about global terrorism, about domestic terrorism, about the powers of the state. Just how do we understand this? Is this an act of terrorism? Is it something else? And what kinds of policy responses can be justified in a world where we understand it as part of the continuum of violence that terrorism is on? I'm Zach Beauchamp, here with Jen Williams and Alex Ward. The family is back together again. Hello, everybody, after a very long time.
The gang is back.
Get ready, America.
We love Jen Kirby. We miss her. And she could replace any one of us, and it would probably be a better show. But, you know, we're all back with you, and you're just going to have to put up with us. So, hi, everybody. We're back. So, Alex, you cut off a vacation early for this, right?
Yep.
Aren't you supposed to be on vacation this week?
That's right.
Well, I mean, everything is kind of going to hell, or it feels that way. So, last week we talked a lot about the details of the attack, and we talked about the international reaction, how this affects American foreign policy when it comes to state-to-state issues. But we haven't talked a lot about the way in which this fits into the national obsession with terrorism that has been going on for about 20 years now, since 9/11. And that sounds derogatory, and I don't mean it to be. I mean, sometimes I do, but we've been so concerned about the threat and the specter of particularly jihadist terrorism that I don't know how seriously the U.S. government has taken the threat of right-wing terrorism. In fact, in the Trump era, I know it hasn't been that serious. So, but I guess before we get into these sorts of comparisons, I want to back up, Jen, and start with you and say, was this terrorism? Like, do we understand it? Is that a useful frame for understanding what happened last week?
Yeah, so that's, I think, a really important question. I wrote a piece on this shortly after the events on Capitol Hill, kind of breaking down what that term actually means, and what it means kind of depends on who's using it and what purpose they have in using that term, right? So it's helpful to think of terrorism in kind of three different ways. There are other ways, there are additional things here, but for our purposes here, they're kind of like three different buckets. So if you're an analyst, right, or a scholar who studies terrorism, or, you know, for our purposes here, we're, you know, dissecting this analytically, there is one way that they look at it, right? There's the kind of academic view, which is, you know, it has to meet this certain criteria, political violence, right? It's a tactic rather than like a group. You know, groups can use a bunch of different tactics. They can use conventional military tactics, guerrilla tactics. Terrorism is just kind of one piece. So it is the act itself rather than like the group. So we're not saying like, were these far right, you know, groups that were involved in the Capitol, are they terrorists? But rather, was this particular act an act of terrorism? I personally, and several, you know, many other scholars would probably say yes in this case. And that's because it meets kind of the basic criteria, right? There's an explicit use of violence for a political motive intended to cause, you know, fear or accomplish some goal, right? Then there's kind of the legal one. And that's where the question, I think, gets a little murky. If you're, you know, the FBI or, you know, law enforcement, whether or not you label this terrorism has more to do with whether you think you can prosecute a terrorism case under existing statutes in a court of law. So what we're seeing, you know, a lot of the charges come out of this are specific crimes, right? They are things like, you know, being in a public place illegally or destruction of property, rather than just, you know, terrorism as like a you know, legal definition as a charge. We're seeing some discussion of potentially charging people under, you know, things like sedition, insurrection. So, you know, when you're the FBI, when you're a law enforcement organization, terrorism, that's what they are kind of looking for in terms of, does it meet this like legal definitional criteria? And can I get that conviction in a court of law? And then the third one is kind of what we're all used to seeing, which is the, you know, media, pundits, politicians, and they, you know, will often tend to use terrorism as like a slur almost. Like, if they are bad guys, if they did a bad thing, then they are terrorists, right? And it's less an analytical and more of a political kind of label. You know, if they did violence against your side, or if it was the other side or something like that, right? They are bad guys, therefore they did a terrorism. So I think for me, in this case, Alex, you're making faces at me.
Yeah, Alex, why are you making faces at Jen? What are you?
Oh, no, I was just laughing at they did a terrorism.
Oh, okay.
They did a terrorism. Okay.
All right.
Because I thought what she was saying was basically non-controversial here. Like,
there's no controversy.
We're going through the definitions.
Right, yeah. Okay.
I disagree with the scholarly definitions. No.
Right. So, yeah. So, you know, I think for our purposes here, like, you know, my background is as an analyst and, you know, in academia doing, you know, scholarly research work on counterterrorism, I would very much probably call this an act of terrorism. Like, you know, it was overtly political. It, you know, targeted non-combatants. That's not necessarily always a criteria, but, you know, this was outside war. So it wasn't an act of war in the sense of like, there's no defined conflict going on. You know, but it regardless, it falls under kind of a broader umbrella of political violence, right? I think even if we don't pinpoint specifically terrorism, yes or no, I think it does fit into a broader, there's no question it was political violence.
So I think that's right, right? That it's like, it's obviously a form of political violence. For me, the terrorism question is both important and not important, right? I think it is unimportant in the sense that a lot of this is either academic hair splitting, which is obviously significant in a journal article, but not necessarily for public consumption, or just a debate over whether to label these people as like bad people, which we all agree they're bad. We don't need to make them extra special bad by calling them terrorists. Like, that's the colloquial definition that Jen was just talking about. And I don't think like debates over those two things are particularly important. I think what does matter when we talk about terrorism, and I think this does sort of relate to that last colloquial definition, is that we understand this as being continuous with the kind of event and reaction to events that we had after 9/11. Right? 9/11 was this incredible shock to the American system, and it led to all sorts of, honestly, like very bad policy reactions. Ranging from the Patriot Act to the institution of torture to the invasion of Iraq. These were all catastrophic for a variety of different reasons and to varying degrees. But it also created some useful things, right? Really serious attention to transnational jihadist violence and to preparing for terrorist events that, like, there's a reason why there wasn't a significant major transnationally organized attack in the United States after 9/11 on the scope of 9/11. And it's because the security apparatus did good things in terms of intelligence sharing and preparations for this kind of violence that could help head them off. That wasn't the only reason why that didn't happen, but it was a significant one, in addition to some of the international military tactics. So in terms of thinking about this, like, we need to start not only shifting our focus from jihadist terrorism, which is something that the U.S. has been slowly doing for a while now as a result of these non-attacks and a series of pretty violent white nationalist and right-wing incidents in the country. But also we need to take the lessons of the post 9/11 years very seriously and understand that there are a variety of different policy responses that fall under the sort of broad umbrella of what we do in reaction to non-state or terrorist violence. And to think about which ones have been effective and which ones have been counterproductive and which ones have just been frankly immoral.
Yeah, not to, you know, put too fine a point on it, just to summarize, I think, you know, in a sentence or so, you know, the terrorism label matters in the sense of thinking about how we respond to it.
I want to echo, because I think this is an incredibly important point. The terrorism label to me matters because it will actually define a policy response. It will define a societal response to what the challenge is. And we saw this after 9/11 when it became, when we created the DHS and all these other issues that Zach mentioned. And the nation frankly cared about it. It was a top policy issue for a bunch of people. They voted people in because of their views on terrorism, many of them bad, but it became an issue of national concern. And if we move on from this and just say it was sort of a one-off attack by a certain extreme group and not, as Zach mentioned, a continuous part of a campaign, a thing that has been plaguing this country for decades, then we take our eye off the ball. And right now in the country, and especially in government, they're having a discussion about, well, what does that post-9/11 world look like? In some people's minds, it means, you know, prioritizing other issues like climate change and you know, improving the middle class and ending the wars. And all that is good. I'm not denting that. But I would argue that a post-9/11 era, at least one aspect of it should be, is that move that you make, a very clear rhetorical and policy move from caring about jihadism more than anything else, and you care about far-right extremism in the U.S. And that requires the government to call it out. It requires the government to make it a major policy concern. Otherwise, you deal with it piecemeal as opposed to holistically.
Yeah, so I think for me, I want to be really careful here because I don't think it's actually super helpful to treat it as an either or. And I'm not suggesting that either of you are. You know, I don't think it's a, I don't think there's a dichotomy. You know, I think it's a false dichotomy to say we have to focus either on jihadist terrorism or on far-right terrorism, right? I think part of the problem, we've actually seen this historically, you know, in past decades in the U.S., we've kind of gone back and forth, actually, between these two poles, if you will. You know, there was the 1993 World Trade Center bombing that was done by jihadist terrorists. So after that, when the bombing at Oklahoma City happened, the initial response and thought from law enforcement was, oh, it must be, you know, Islamic jihadists. Well, it turns out it was Timothy McVeigh. It was, you know, pro-militia, anti-government kind of extremists, right? And they essentially missed that. And then, you know, there was a lot of focus because of that. You know, at the time, that was the deadliest terrorist attack in American history on American soil, in modern American history, I should say. And so there was a lot of focus then kind of shifting back more towards, you know, an emphasis domestically on paying attention to the kind of far right extremist kind of anti-government threat. And then, you know, 9/11 happens and they missed that because we weren't paying as much attention to the jihadist threat, right? And so now we focused on that and we've started to miss the far right threat again, right? So I think what's really important is to make sure that we're not taking too specific or too kind of rigid an approach and going, you know, 180 one or the other. I think understanding that, first of all, that a lot of these groups share a lot of traits in common, both in terms of tactics, in terms of, you know, recruitment, in terms of communications online, even in some ideological strains. And we can talk about this more later, but there are neo-Nazi groups who openly praise Osama bin Laden, who use ISIS imagery in their own, you know, their own imagery and their own recruiting and in their literature, who are openly borrowing from, you know, ISIS tactics and from Al-Qaeda. So I think I just want to kind of put that out there, that I don't think we should be too rigid in saying we need to focus on this or this.
To be clear, I'm not saying that there should be an either or. What I'm saying is that there is an important psychological aspect to this in terms of governance, right? When I say terrorism, like, what comes to your mind? My guess is it's something like Al-Qaeda. And there are good reasons for that, of course. But when we're looking at what is actually the longer term threat to the U.S., something that has been plaguing this country for a long time, when we snap our fingers, we need to at least also have in our minds the kind of threat that we faced last week. And well, good news, at least like Homeland Security and the U.S. government has said now the biggest threat to the United States is far-right extremist terrorism and white nationalism and all that. So we're moving in that direction, but there hasn't really been, and we touched upon it earlier, because Donald Trump doesn't consider it to be a big deal, but like it needs to be signaled as a big deal. I agree. Focus on both. Give them the important attention here and other forms of terrorism. These aren't the only two. But I think if we're talking about what the U.S. is facing, when we snap our fingers, when we think of what is the terrorist threat to the United States, you need to have both in mind at least.
My concern about the way that this conversation often goes is that there's like a one-way ratchet towards doing more and giving the government more power, right? That when you say we should be more concerned about these things, we need to be more concerned about white nationalism and not necessarily less about jihadism. Well, when you make that argument in that way, you end up making an argument implicitly for the government having more ability to go after more people and for loosening civil liberties restrictions and allowing more surveillance, or at least if not making an argument for it, certainly creating the conditions in which the argument for those things becomes more plausible. And this is like not a hypothetical concern right now. The Biden people have at one point during the campaign proposed a new domestic terrorism law that would allow for law enforcement have increased powers in going after white nationalists. And like, that sounds good in theory, but in practice, these laws get abused really, really easily in ways that are both like morally wrong and counterproductive. One of the things that radicalized Timothy McVeigh, who we've been talking about, were the uses of force by the state at Ruby Ridge and Waco. Right. And they weren't against militias exactly, right? It was, just people that they found sympathetic victims who the state viewed as, for a variety of reasons that are not really worth getting into right now, enemies are dangerous. And so when you give government agents more powers to surveil, arrest, and even commit violence in the pursuit of arrests, right, you end up not only getting innocent people hurt, as the 9/11 experience should really make us think about, given the massive number of civilian casualties that have come from the war on terrorism and the harm done by U.S. agents for people who are in our custody, but also ends up inspiring more violence by making the victims of the United States seem sympathetic, even when they shouldn't be sympathetic. I really don't think anyone should think that zip tie guy who looked like he wanted to capture members of Congress and maybe execute them is like a nice and friendly guy. But if people like him are unfairly victimized by the U.S. government, their civil liberties violated, that could be a serious problem.
And this becomes tricky for a pretty simple reason. When you're dealing with, you know, jihadist terrorism around the world, it's kind of like a military problem. At least we treat it that way, right? If you're dealing with terrorists at home, it becomes a law enforcement problem. And that is a different set of resources, legal rationales, requirements, et cetera. And since they actually kind of effectively have to go through the U.S. legal system, it makes it somewhat harder to build cases and prosecute and all that. So it would require a pretty big sort of focus shift and a move more towards a law enforcement function in this case. And we're already seeing the complexities of that with the Capitol.
I think there's a third piece here, and I definitely want to get into some more specific conversation about who exactly was involved and where these different groups fall in the kind of spectrum of far-right political violence and what their confluence actually means for the threat profile and what to do. But there's a kind of a third piece here that I think is really important in terms of acknowledging the far-right domestic terrorist threat, and that is acknowledging that it is a homegrown threat in the sense of, you know, when we think about a lot of times, like the jihadist threat, it's a foreign threat, right? It's portrayed as this others, right? It's this outside force, even though there are plenty of homegrown, you know, people who are radicalized, who were American citizens, et cetera, in the United States. You know, the conception, I think, you know, we're seeing from even just in the aftermath of this Capitol attack, right? Like all these people were live streaming their actions and posting on social media. And all of a sudden, all these people's family members and friends are going online and going, that's my cousin. That's my neighbor. That guy lives down the street from me. Oh, God, that was my dad. Like, people are, you know, and they're contacting law enforcement. And I think that's that's something we need to recognize, right? This is us. This is America, right? This is a problem that is not some foreign invading force, that is not some foreign ideology, that is not some scary other, right? This is something that is fundamentally happening inside the United States among, you know, a fairly disturbing swath of American citizens. And I think understanding that and not, you know, thinking of terrorism as this kind of other foreign thing, you know, a lot of it has been framed anti-immigration, right? We don't want to let terrorists into our country. But if we're talking about this specific recent attack, right? These were people who came from all over the United States, who were, you know, mostly white, who were, you know, people's neighbors and friends and colleagues. And, you know, I think just that fundamental understanding of that this is not something that is like, you know, needs to be kind of blocked out and build a wall and keep people out, right? It's already here. It is us, meaning it is America. And it is something that we have to deal with as a society ourselves, and acknowledging that this is like a cancer that has grown inside the American body politic that has to be excised, but carefully, because it is, again, part of our country right now.
So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to pick up a little bit on two things that Jen said. First, I'm going to push her This Is Us analogy in a perhaps provocative direction. And second, we're going to talk about the taxonomy of the different groups that are involved and how to think about them in the terrorism spectrum. Welcome back, worldly listeners. We have been talking about how to think about the question of, was the Capitol Hill riot a form of terrorism? And if so, we think it's certainly plausible to treat it as such. Like, what does that mean in terms of how we understand the response and its role in American security policy? Now, before the break, Jen was talking about how this can't be separated from the United States and our self-conception in the way that other kinds of terrorism sometimes are, right? Because they're perpetrated literally by foreigners. I want to push this a step further, right? Like, one thing that we talk about in the terrorism literature is state sponsorship, right? Is that some terrorist groups are, if not directed by governments, certainly supported by governments or political factions inside the government that see the terrorists as a useful proxy. I don't want to say exactly that the Republican Party and Donald Trump are the state sponsors of these people, but the line is a lot closer than we might want it to be, right? And this isn't just that Trump encouraged and incited the violence beforehand, and in fact, for years, had been telling far-right groups like the Proud Boys that the famous quote from the debate this year was stand back and stand by towards the Proud Boys. He'd been inciting violence at his rallies for years. The president seems to like violence by his supporters. You know, you also had members of Congress taking people on a suspicious amount of tours. That's not my language. It's another member of Congress who thought that they saw people who were rioters the next day being toured around in ways that seemed like a tactical briefing by other members of Congress. The Capitol Police have suggested that there are members of Congress in some reports who may have some culpability in what happened. Obviously, there are some Republicans who reportedly had a role in planning the rally itself. Whether or not they planned the violence or helped any of the planning in that is still an open question. Again, it's not quite state sponsorship in the way that we ordinarily understand it, but the lines between actual factions of the U.S. government, including the President of the United States, and armed violent groups are much blurrier than we'd want them to be, or than makes a policy response necessarily as easy as it might be otherwise, right? It's complicating when there are actual members of the government who have linkages to these violent groups.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should be clear that we don't have any direct evidence, like, so far that members of Congress were involved in planning the violence, right? Like Zach said, these are reports and statements that I assume are being investigated right now, but so far, these are still just kind of allegations. So I just kind of want to be careful there on that. But at the same time, you do have the photo of Josh Hawley, Republican, who is walking into the Capitol as there was this, you know, mob of protesters gathered outside right when he's going in to start the voting, you know, to certify the 2020 election results. And he holds up his fist in solidarity. That can't be erased, right? That is something that happened. You had, you know, President Trump, as you said, at a rally with a group of these people who said, let's go march to the Capitol. He also said he was going to march with them, and then Secret Service told him he couldn't. But it wasn't just that, right? You had the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, saying we need to have trial by combat to solve this. And yes, you can say, well, that's just rhetoric. That's political rhetoric. We talk about politics and fighting and politics all the time, and nobody means physical violence. But when it adds up over time and you see, you know, Trump saying things like encouraging, you know, law enforcement to be rougher with suspects when they're putting them in police cars, right? Or when you, you know, offer to pay the, you know, legal fees of someone who beats up a protester at a rally, right? That is an kind of explicit and implicit call for violence that, you know, more extreme supporters on the, you know, we can debate whether they're the fringes or at the core of some of Trump's supporters, but they hear that as a call to arms, a literal call to arms. You know, whether or not the people saying that literally meant, I want you to bear arms and go storm the Capitol, that's how it was taken. And it's not hard to see why, right? And, you know, I think part of the issue here, and this is something I want to get into, is kind of the wide array of groups that were involved at the Capitol, but who were all kind of united by Donald Trump, right? There was a huge kind of vast array across the kind of far right political spectrum of people. But the one kind of unifying thing was Trump and his rhetoric and his call and his saying, you know, democracy is being stolen. Your country is being stolen. We need to fight back. And they answered the call. And the result was, you know, a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol.
There were videos of some people that were in that group. They were basically going, we were here, the president invited us. Like,
right,
That's how they felt. And it's hard to see why they shouldn't see it that way. Like, it makes sense. I mean, Trump was even like, I'll be there with you. And then he left.
And he said, we love you, you're special, as they was still going on.
Right. No, yeah. I mean, even though he was sort of initially was like, this is bad, violence bad, but also we love you, you're great, you're awesome. I mean, he loves anyone that loves him. I find it fascinating. This conversation reminds me of one of my least favorite arguments in this whole thing, which is, and you usually hear from right-leaning folks, especially when it comes to jihadist terrorism, they go like, why doesn't the Muslim world or the Islamic community like police themselves? Why can't they like call this out or whatever? And now I'm kind of thinking like, where are you guys? Why aren't you calling this out? You know, you had a moment to impeach the president. Some Republicans did, but most didn't. You know, this was the moment to say, okay, our bad, you know, we fed the beast that ate us. But they haven't. There's no culpability here. And so one, that was always sort of a nasty argument and a bigoted one when it came to jihadist terrorism. But
and also, I just want to add, you're absolutely right, but also false, because Muslim,
right, yes,
you know, leaders and organizations and individuals have been calling it out literally over and over. But yes, go on.
Right. And another important point of disanalogy is that we're talking about a specific organizational structure. If people had been like, well, X mosque had a role given its imam's rhetoric in radicalizing this group of people, why aren't they condemning the violence that their rhetoric like potentially promoted? That would be one thing. But it's saying like all Muslims anywhere is generally the term of this argument. It's pretty messed up. Whereas in this case, there's a specific organization, which is to say the Republican Party, with a specific set of leaders who have been playing footsie with this kind of rhetoric. I wrote something on the site about this, but there is a very, very, very long history in the Republican Party, especially in conversations centering on guns, of arguing that insurrection against the U.S. government might be justifiable if Democratic policies are passed, gun control most notably, but also several other ones, right? You know, in 2009, Representative Don Young, who's still in Congress, signed a letter written by an actual far-right militia member calling for violence against the U.S. government if gun control is passed. And the person who wrote that letter, who drafted it, was subsequently arrested for on charges of attempting to abduct U.S. government officials. Like, this is not, again, a particularly new thing. It's something that has blended for a long time through a strategy on the parts of some members of the party of seeing these people as potential constituents. And people, this kind of language is one that motivates and energizes the base. But now you have a broad and deep set of movements that take this rhetoric very seriously, and that see themselves and see like they're being a conduit between the official Republican Party and them, which is to say Donald Trump, that makes them more invested in partisan disputes. You know, in the past, you would be more likely to get far militias saying the entire political spectrum is pointless and useless. The Republicans are just as bad as the Democrats, etc. And a lot of that still exists. But the way that Trump has interacted with violence makes a lot of people on the far right feel like it's actually our party. Like our interests are being represented and we've effected a kind of takeover of a mainstream institution and made it less hostile to our vision of what the country ought to be, which makes them in turn more likely to engage in violence in pursuit of partisan disputes, right? And that are involved and engaged in partisan disagreements.
I want to point out a very specific event that I think really showcases this in terms of Trump. If you remember, around November of this past year, there was a huge, disturbing, terrifying kidnapping plot against Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. And it was revealed, and the people who were involved were caught. And it was an extremely detailed plot. They were surveilling her. They had plans to kidnap her, potentially kill her, right? It was really horrifying. And a lot of this was specifically over, you know, masking and lockdown orders related to coronavirus, but also kind of a broader anti-government sentiment. When that happened, the president didn't respond in the way that you would think that a president would respond, by saying, you know, this is completely unacceptable. Do not do this, right? He continued to essentially criticize her for, you know, imposing stay-at-home orders, things like that. And, you know, at one point, the crowd is chanting at a Trump rally. He mentions her. They're chanting, lock her up. And he says, quote, I don't comment on that because every time if I make just even a little bit of a nod, they say the president led them on. Now, I don't have to lead you on. And then he went on to say of the actual alleged plot against Whitmer, maybe it was a problem, maybe it wasn't. Like, that is not, that is a very clear wink and a nod that violence against sitting government officials is acceptable and potentially encouraged, right? He had an opportunity to say, yeah, you literally can't do this. You can't plot to kidnap and potentially kill someone that I disagree with their policies or whatever, because he's talked about her for a long time and railed against her, especially around the coronavirus stuff. But then there was this plot and he had the opportunity to say, this is not what I meant, and he didn't. And that's the kind of thing that I think specifically led directly to this exact attack that we saw, right? It's just an escalation. Well, if that was okay, why not take it directly to the U.S. Capitol, right? And I think that's the kind of thing that we see when you're talking about state sponsorship of terrorism. No, Trump isn't literally funding a far-right militia, right? He's not, you know, buying weapons in Chechnya and shipping them to Oregon, right, to support a militia group or a training camp. But rhetorically, he's giving them the kind of political cover to engage in this kind of violence and saying, you know, without explicitly saying it, but pretty clearly encouraging it, saying, this is acceptable, this will win my good graces, this is the kind of thing that I want to see. And that is terrifying.
You know, we're nearing the end of the Trump era. This is our last episode before he's out of office. And, well, for this term at least, you know, I keep thinking about what his legacy is going to be. And I think there's tons of fodder. But the more I think about this and the challenges the U.S. will face, I don't think it's going to be that he was, you know, impeached twice, or that he oversaw the most mass deaths of Americans in a term, or he oversaw an economic collapse or failed to end wars that he promised to end. It's going to be that he did really nothing to stop a massive terrorist threat to the United States, and in fact, egged it on, promoted it, incited it, played a pretty big part on one of the greatest attacks on the U.S. government in centuries, frankly. And that is something that is going to be left for Biden and future presidents to deal with. A report from the Department of Homeland Security from 2011 said at the time there were 6,000 hate groups. I would bet there are more now. And I would bet that they're more active and more violent. And you're also seeing one of the greatest runs on buying guns ever in American history. This could only get worse, and we've been trying to pinpoint the person or the party. It is the Republican Party, but I would say that Donald Trump is the, we have a piece on the site about this, and I think it's true. Donald Trump is the accelerant. He is the problem. And this, when I think about the Trump years, this is what I'm going to think about most, that he promoted and made worse a massive security threat on the United States. It is the president's number one job to protect Americans. And he's failed at that in many areas, but especially in this one.
Yeah, I just want to pivot a little bit to talking about these specific groups, because in general, we've been discussing them as sort of like nebulous, violent, far-right factions. But they have a variety of different ideologies that make them more or less amenable to violence under different circumstances, right? Like, you have groups like the Proud Boys that are a Western chauvinist group. They're intensely anti-Muslim, they're anti-Semitic, but not exactly white nationalists. In a way, they have a actually fairly significant amount of minority members involved in them. Really sexist also, and super into street brawling. They're a different kind of violent threat from white nationalist militias, right, who are much more into violent terrorism, especially when they're the accelerationist variety, who believes that you need to do, intense and random acts of violence in order to spur on chaos and destabilize the U.S. government. Then you have 3%ers, who are a gun rights-focused militia group who's opposed to state control, basically anti-government. This is all like a broad, we can get into a variety of other different specific groups. But it's a real motley crew of different factions that have been united in the way that Alex was just talking about, as seeing Trump as an avatar of their belief system, as somebody that is at least in some way useful for them. But in the post-Trump era, I wonder how that fractures and how that leads to, or if it fractures, right? Is it possible that militia groups keep finding common cause under the banner of a kind of like stabbed in the back myth, where Trump was betrayed by the Republican Party and the mainstream system failed, and so we need to work together to undermine it? Do they just go off and do different things? They don't really coordinate right now, but sort of acted in concert in the January 6th uprising. Like, I don't know. It's actually quite complicated to understand this. And I don't know what to expect in terms of whether the overall level of violence will decrease or increase after Trump leaves office.
Yeah, there's actually really good terrorism scholarship that's come out of a lot of this, these kind of developments, that has looked at this. A couple scholars termed it fringe fluidity, this ideological convergence among all these disparate groups. You have, even the neo-Luddites, right? So groups who were kind of suspicious of technology. And you can see that in people, especially around like the anti-vaxxer movement kind of fits in there. Like you said, the 3%ers and the Oath Keepers, a lot of whom recruit from the military. You have even incels, picking up language of white nationalism. You have eco-fascism, which, basically it uses kind of white nationalism and Nazi ideological tropes to kind of argue for saving the planet, right? You have this kind of huge kind of convergence. Another scholar has called it essentially salad bar ideologies. So where, the kind of concept of the salad bar, right? You pick and choose the things that you like, and then you put them all on your plate and that's your meal. So, I think the fracturization of all of these groups is not new, right? I think the issue we're actually dealing with is that these groups were previously all fractured, right? This was a kind of umbrella of just a whole bunch of different groups that didn't interact directly, but borrowed from each other and kind of had a lot of ideological overlaps. The problem is that they have, even QAnon, right? Which is just a bizarre, I don't even know if we're calling it a conspiracy theory anymore. I think,
no, it's definitely a conspiracy theory. It's just a lot of different conspiracy theories.
Yes, I know that it's a conspiracy theory, but I've heard people arguing that it should be, that it's more aptly described as a mass delusion at this point. And even more, almost on the level of religious cult belief, beyond just a, conspiracy theory, just because it's so vast and brings in so many different kind of pieces. And I can't even get into the QAnon, but generally the idea that Trump is fighting this huge cabal of Democrats and pedophiles and Satanists or something. Also, John F. Kennedy Jr. fits in. I don't know. Google it. But
no, don't. Do not. do not do that. This is the worst advice anyone's given on the show so far.
Sorry.
Google it. Don't Bing it. Don't Alta Vista it. Don't anything.
Sorry. Google it and then type in Vox together and get. How about we'll just link to our explainer in the show notes. Let's just do that.
Jen is trying to radicalize you. Jen wants you to believe in Q.
This is online radicalization, right?
Okay. Please don't Google it unless you type Vox with it and go directly to our explainer. Otherwise, oh God, I'm sorry, everyone. I'm sorry, America. No, but I mean, you have the QAnon people were a huge faction, in the Capitol violence, right? The woman who was shot and killed by Capitol Police was a big believer in Q. And so you know, QAnon is not overtly white nationalist, right? They're not neo-Nazis, though there are elements of that. There are pockets of that. There is, you know, again, some ideological overlap. But again, I think the problem is that all of these groups came together literally physically because Trump called to kind of everyone and tapped into this kind of sentiment. And what they all kind of had in common was this support for Trump and this support for the idea that the country was being stolen and that he was calling on patriots, right? It hit kind of all the key highlights, you know, his racist rhetoric for, well, decades. It taps into the kind of white nationalist thing. He, you know, pushes conspiracy theories left and right. His treatment of medical treatments during the coronavirus, right? Pushing unproven cures like hydroxychloroquine, things like that, right? Taps into the anti-vaxxer. Just in general, it's this kind of broad coalition that didn't actually work together that now are all united. And that's the thing that I'm concerned about. It's not that these groups are fractured. They were, and now they're not. And that's what really scares me, is that having actual tactical, strategic, like, conversations and connections between these groups, making these connections directly, is potentially making the threat a lot worse, right? If they're sharing tactics, if they're sharing successes and things like that, that is really scary.
So I want to close the show with a quote, because I've been doing some reporting on this. I'm working on a bigger piece on the potential for increased political violence in the U.S. afterwards. A quote from Jan Berger, who's a terrorism expert who knows a lot about right-wing violence in the United States. And so he told me, and I quote, "It's been decades since there was a large domestic extremist movement with centralized charismatic leadership in this country. If Trump wants to be the man, he can be the man." So that's the question outgoing. Is Trump going to be the man that unites this, or is he, as JM suggests later in our conversation, more likely to be somebody who just kind of throws fuel on the fire but is too disorganized and too disinterested in details to become an actual movement leader? And that's one of the questions we'll look for going forward. I would be stunned if we don't come back to this topic later on in the next few months or years. But for now, I want to encourage all of you to rate and subscribe and review Worldly wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll see you next week to talk about the transition in power, most likely, and what a Biden foreign policy is going to be. Before we go, it's really important that I thank Sophie Lalonde, our producer, who does such a great job with the show after, you know, getting dropped in the deep end pretty early on here. So thanks, Sophie. Take care, y'all.